Session number 17286.
It's Arnold Real Threat. Four.
They would have had the sovereigns off me if I'd had them, but they thought that I'd hidden them well away, so they were, I was safe. And they were kind to me. They were kind, of course, and I was always very conscious of the danger, conscious of the danger to myself and to them. And by then, of course, I had become fairly certain that I was not going to die. I thought, oh yes, Doug, you're leading a charmed life. No way can anything happen to you. You know, you've been adrift for 10 days in an open boat and arrived ashore. You've dropped behind the enemy lines and got picked up. You've escaped for the third time from a prisoner of war camp. Nothing can happen to you, but nevertheless, let's make sure that nothing does. So I always kept a weather word open, and I didn't always sleep under the same roof. I would, I moved about. I made it a moving target. But the partisans were very, very brave people. Rogues, bandits they were, certainly, but they were very, very brave, very, very brave. And the people who let us stay in their houses were even more brave. I mean, had I been picked up, I might have been just put back in another, depending upon who picked me up, I could well have gone into another prisoner of war camp, in Germany, perhaps, but, you know, I might have been shot, but it could have happened that I'd been just a prisoner of war. But they would certainly have been shot, and their house would have been, you know, torched. Oh, yes, the family killed and the house burned. So, I was conscious of this all the while. But eventually our troops were coming further and further north, and the partisans were now simply ransacking the Germans. They were no longer partisans. They were just plain bandits, robbing, and there was a little bit of killing, taking, you know, striking back at the people who had befriended the Germans. And I wanted to have nothing to do with this, and I thought the best thing I can do is to get back to the go south. And I...
Why did you not want to have anything to do with it?
Ah. Well, I couldn't have controlled them. And when it came to killing the local fascists who had befriended and the German troops, and when it came to doing shocking things to the local girls who had slept with the German troops, I wanted to have none of that, and I knew that I couldn't control them. And on the nights when they went rampaging, and the cognac was, if they'd robbed a liquor store, they would take no notice of me. So I thought that it was the best thing for me to do was to get out of it before the British troops came there. And of course, I thought it was easier to move south while the Germans were moving north than to wait until the Germans, the frontline Germans, actually got to St. Egidio and were surrounding me. I thought I could have been in trouble then. I thought the best thing for me to do was to go south. And so with a young priest, theological student, who had befriended me in the village and had been a good boy, he guided me down to where he'd been told the British troops were and got me through the lines. And to my amazement, to my complete amazement, I didn't hear a shot fired for about 2 hours. I went through the Germans, met the British, and met some fellows having tea. They were a forward artillery group. A forward artillery group. And they were delighted to see me, treated me quite casually, made me some tea, etc. Gave Gaspari, this young priest, a large carton of cigarettes and a pair of boots, and sent him back to St. Egidio. And they said that they were moving up. They said, oh, the Germans are retreating very, very rapidly, and they're moving up. And I showed them where St. Egidio was, and they said, oh, well, if you've been there for a year, I think you ought to go back there tomorrow. You can come with us. So they took me to 2 or 3 miles from St. Egidio the following day, and I walked across the fields and back to the people whom I knew. And people by now, of course, they knew that things were, they were safe. And people and everybody had become a partisan, and they were going around firing their guns in the air. The all the old shotguns had been resurrected from the barns and the stables, etc., and from under the floorboards. And everybody was going around shouting, "I was a partisan, I was a partisan, and I have saved you," etc. And they were firing their guns in the air. And I went back to these people with all the goodies that this forward observation group had given me, cartons of cigarettes and tea and things like that, gave them everything that I had, and then shot off to some other British troops who posted me back, strangely enough, to Naples. That was the reception area. So I eventually sailed from Naples, and Naples was the first place that I'd arrived at, which was good, wasn't it? That was good. So I went to Naples, and after all this Spartan food that I'd had for 2 years, it was September, so now it was just 2 years. 2 years since I'd been taken prisoner the second time in North Africa. 2 years. And short commons, you know. I get to Naples, and everybody wants to buy me a pint and give me a Mars bar and ice cream. And Naples was the place where the Allied troops were concentrating upon. Badoglio was there, and they were concentrating on that, and all the stuff came in. The black market was rife. Plenty of food, everybody had food, and the naffy, etc. Oh, yes, I lived on ice cream and Mars bars and pints. Of course, I came out in some terrible spots and boils and etc. And after, a very short time, perhaps no more than a fortnight, I doubt if it was a fortnight, I was told that a troop ship would take me back to Great Britain. And by now I was covered in boils, particularly on my bottom, eating all this rich food. After eating the Spartan grub, now I'm eating Mars bars and ice creams. And I didn't dare report sick. I thought, if I go into a hospital for these boils, miss this troop ship, I might never, you know, might stay here for a long time. So on a troop ship I was put, and they assured me that my mother had been informed. Incidentally, I've got the telegram which my mother received, saying that her son was now in Allied hands and was waiting to be transported home. I came home on this troop ship and didn't know where we were going to land. And I don't suppose the sailors knew where they were going to land either. But we came into the Mersey, and it was wonderful. We came into the Mersey, and I saw the Bar lightship, and I knew that I was on home ground. And we were taken, when we landed, we were taken on the ferry boat to a place called Eastham Woods, to a reception centre. And this was just like going to the reception centre in Italy, where I'd first
Naples.
In first landed in Naples, yes. It was just as badly, everything was hopeless. And there's a charming camp commandant there, just some huts in Eastham Woods, where I used to go as a kid on picnics. I knew Eastham Woods well, and I had a married sister who lived just beyond Eastham Woods. And there was a charming gentleman who was the camp commandant. He must have been, I suppose, about 40. And to me, what was I then? I was then 23, wasn't I? A man of 40 was over the hill, terribly old, and he was wearing a First World War medal ribbon, which I respected. Oh, yes, I respected that, but You know, I thought anybody who can work, who's in the last war must be quite over the hill. Of course he is. And he explained to us that he was never informed when groups such as us were to be received, because obviously they didn't publicise convoys arriving. And so he didn't have anything ready, but within an hour or two, food would arrive. And in the meantime, a fellow called Sonny Hale, do you remember? You're not old enough to remember Sonny Hale. No. He was a wartime, well, pre-war and wartime entertainer. He was married, I think, to a lady called Binnie Barnes, and he was part of ENSA. And Sonny Hale was coming with his troop to entertain us. And in the meantime, nobody was to leave this little camp. We were to stay there until till registration tomorrow. And he regretted that there were no telephone there, because all he had was a landline to an army camp about 4 miles away. And in the meantime, have a good time and enjoy Sonny Hale. So Sonny Hale, yeah, he came on and told stories, etc., and everybody was pleased. We had no money in our pocket. You know, we had no money. We'd been given paper money on this troop ship coming back, which enabled us to buy things, you know, cigarettes or whatever, but most things were given to us free. We were, after all, returning heroes, you know. We were heroes. So I went back to this camp commandant, who was standing there, old and dejected. I suppose he really wanted to be a frontline soldier, but he'd been lumbered with this awful reception camp in the middle of Eastern Woods, with a lot of fellows who came there all getting drunk and raping the local girls, I think, he thought. So I said, can I have a word with you? Yes, certainly. So I said, well, I have a sister who lives just across the field. So he regarded his fingernails for a little while, and he said, every bugger that comes to my camp has got a mother or a sister who lives just across the field. He said, I know, you're going to go there, get drunk, and the girls in Eastham. He said, well, I'm here to stop you doing just that. He said, you're not leaving this camp until tomorrow, then you'll be registered, and then you'll be packed into army transport and sent home. So I didn't say, well, I've escaped from better camps than this, you know, but I did say, oh, well, I don't think that you'll be able to keep me here. He said, oh, yes, I can. He said, you'll be shot or something. And I had visions, you know, this little man, you know, tired out as he was. I'm sure he was the salt of the earth, and he was probably kind to his wife and grown-up children. But to me, he was an old, old man in a shabby uniform. And I didn't want anything to do with him. He thought that I was going to go to Eastham and get drunk. I don't know what I was going to use to get drunk on. But I said, I'm going. And I did. I walked out. And he stood there dancing up and down. I nipped through the fields, went through Eastham Woods, and there was my sister's house. And this is hilarious. I crossed the stile, crossed the road, and knocked at my sister's door. And two or three children opened the window over the door. There's a side door, shop at the front, door at the side, and a window over the side door. And three little faces, my nephew and two nieces, opened the window, and they said, oh, it's a soldier. Me mum's out. And I had visions of lines of soldiers queuing outside my sister's door, you know. I had visions of this, so I said, oh, well, I am a soldier, but I'm your Uncle Doug. No, my Uncle Doug's in Italy. You're not my Uncle Doug. I said, yes, I am. Where's your mum? So they eventually told me that their mother was in a house in the immediate vicinity, two or three doors away. And I went there and knocked at the door, and I said, can I see Mrs. Sturzico? I tell her it's her brother. And the lady came back to the door and said, brother, you know, brother. She too could barely believe it, but eventually my sister came to the door, not expecting me at all. To them, they'd been informed by this telegram that I'd got through the lines, but they didn't expect me home within the fortnight or whatever. Yes, so, of course, we went back into her house, and I was introduced to my nieces and my nephew. And I had no intention of going back to the camp that night, no intention whatsoever. And she had a very, very nice, I was introduced to a steel table, about the size of that, but it was made of steel. Did you have one in your house for an anti or a bomb-proof table? And she said, we sleep
a
under
Morrison
this.
Shelter.
No, it was a bomb-proof. She had a Morrison shelter in the garden, but this was a metal table, and you put your sleep, you put your pillows underneath, and you slept. And if the roof fell, then it didn't stop a bomb. But if the roof fell, you were more or less safe. So I said, no, I shall be all right. And first thing in the morning, I went back to this camp, and I said to the bloke, sir, what happened last night? So they said, oh, we had to get Sonny Hale back again for a second performance because there was nothing else in the evening. And they eventually got us some tea and coffee and things and cakes. And I believe this morning everything will be all right. And this morning everything was all right. All of the documentation came. We were given passes for the train, and I was given a pass to come home to this house. Oh, it was wonderful. Of course, I had phoned up, I should have mentioned, I'd phoned up my mother from my sister's house. And these fellows, of course, they'd been stuck there in the camp. They said, wish that we'd come out with you. As well, perhaps if this bloke had seen us all leaving, he would have sent for the military police and had us rounded up. He probably didn't think it was worth reporting one. Anyway, I came home here. And
to Tullycavan.
To Tullycavan. Got off the train at Tullycavan. And the vicar was there to meet me, because my mother, she was living here alone, you see. She'd lost one brother at Dunkirk, the Harry Roberts Arnold that I'd told you about. He had been killed at Dunkirk, so she'd lost him, and she thought, she for a year while I was with the partisans, she knew nothing about me. No, I'd just missing. But now she knew that I was here, and she'd gone around the village telling everybody, you know, my son's coming home, my son's coming home. And if they didn't know, she would stop and tell them, see. So the vicar was there to meet me. He was probably the only one who had petrol for his car and brought me up home. And here in the house, there was an elderly lady. I dimly remembered her. She was an honorary auntie. An honorary auntie, yes. Yes. And there was a young lady with her, and my mother said, do you remember Auntie Polly? So I said, oh, yes. And this is her daughter, Mavanwy. And I thought, oh, this is a bit of all right. You know, this young lady. And she said, oh, I'm a nurse, and I'm just starting a month's leave today, and I live just the other side of the river, and on the other side of the bridge. And I thought, this is handy, you know, having a young lady come to visit me on my first day home, and she's got a month's leave, and I've got a month's leave. And, of course, she's my wife, who's out there now. She married me. She said, why are you limping? And I said, well, I've got a boil. I said, on the bottom. Oh, she said, let's have a look. I said, you're not seeing my bottom. So she said, oh, I've seen lots. I'm a nurse. You know, you can trust me. I'm a nurse. I said, no way. But Mavanwy, my mother, and Auntie Polly got me over the chair in which you're sitting now. And I bent over, and they took my trousers down, and the van said, oh, God, that is a nasty old carbuncle, isn't it? And she put a dressing on it. And, of course, she had to come back the next day to repair the dressing, and the day after that to repair the dressing. And in a very short while, we were engaged. And I've always said that she got me with my trousers down when I was in a very, very weak state. And she's had me in the same state ever since.
Did you get back into the SA?
Oh, yes, after the end of the month. At the end of the month, I reported back to Aberystwyth, to a rehabilitation centre, which was the third hilarious camp that I'd been in. Yes, yes. Really hilarious. The doctors didn't know much about rehabilitation. They'd suddenly had all these ex-prisoners of war, and they'd been warned about people with shell shock who were likely to kid you up, etc. And they didn't really know what to do with us. So they were saying, can you count backwards from 10? Well, that's not so bad. So I said, backwards from 10. Now, well, what way? And I did the most stupid thing, because I just couldn't abide this. You know, it was so clownish. And I couldn't I'm a nonconformist. I couldn't conform. I couldn't go along the easy path. I couldn't say 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, etc. I had them going in circles. And when they said, oh, go out through the door to the next doctor and turn left, I would deliberately turn right and go into the doctor, who would think that I had been to the previous doctors and would be asking me even sillier questions, you see. And so I don't know how I passed out A1, but I had some good friends in the SAS and I'd contacted them. By now, the young lieutenant, Paddy Main, who was with me the night I was taken prisoner, was now Colonel Main and in charge of the SAS, so my mother had written to him. She'd written to him to say that I was home. And my good mate, Bob Bennett, who was with me the night that I got captured, he'd taken my revolver and I'd given him all my things, etc. He was now the Sergeant Major. So I contacted them and they got me out and back into the Special Air Service. And within days, I was back in France. There was, you know, I could think of no reason for going back to the Liverpool Scottish and spit and polish. You know, after what I'd been doing, I'd had a relatively easy life, hadn't I, you know, and certainly no discipline. And I thought, oh, God, no. Going back to the Liverpool Scottish and having, you know, up at 4 o'clock, Rivali, whatever time it is, you know, and polishing my rifle. I didn't even have it. Oh, well. So they got me back into France and put me in the intelligence office to get me au fait with what was going on. I had about a fortnight in the intelligence office learning what was happening. And then we all went over to France in our jeeps and we went herding around. And it was like...
Where were you based in France?
Oh, we're on the... it moved all the time. Went through France, Belgium, Holland, and into Germany. I can't remember a single name except Osnabrück. Osnabrück is the only name. We were on the move. We were doing forward observation in our jeeps for some Canadian armoured regiment with their artillery. And we went through the lines like a dose of salt and got behind the Germans and then radioed back to these Canadians who would send their, first of all, would send their artillery over to where we had told them the Germans were, and then the armoured vehicles would come through. And we were keeping about 10 miles, or whatever, you know, I say 10 miles, it might have been 5 or 6, I don't know. We would keep ahead of them all the time and kept on informing them what was going on until we got to Germany. And then all of a sudden I realised that the war was as good as over. There were white flags everywhere, you know, white flags everywhere. You get to a village and not only did the civilians hold white flags, which is eminently sensible, the troops would have white flags. And I suddenly lost all my respect for the German soldiers. In the desert, I'd had immense respect for them. In Italy, again, I had immense respect for the German soldiers. They fought a very clean war. And I had never thought that they would, although I knew that they would get beaten, I never thought that they would react in this bitter manner that they were acting in now. Destroying villages and killing people, etc., in Holland. Dreadful. I thought, no, this is not for me. I don't like these anymore. And as soon as I saw that the war was drawing to a close, I managed to remember Paddy Main was now my colonel. Bob Bennett was my sergeant major. And I'd had no leave except this month for several years. And I said, I'm sure you can do without me. Anything to do back? Yeah, we've got, this has all got to be taken back to Chelmsford. And I said, that's me. I'm off back home to Chelmsford. And I took over the intelligence office in Chelmsford for a very short time. I managed to get myself returned to the unit, which had to be the Camerons, the Liverpool Scottish was a cadet unit of the Camerons, you understand, and nobody knew where the Liverpool Scottish were. I think they were hiding in a church somewhere in Bootle or Liverpool or something. The thing to do was to, they would send me to the Cameron Highlanders, and they were in Germany. I thought, oh, that's okay, fine. And they sent me to Hamelin, to where the Pied Piper was, indeed, and the 5th Battalion of the Camerons were there. And this amused and amazed me. I arrived with an intake, people being returned from their other units, and people who were on sick, etc. And we were told to line up in the courtyard of this magnificent castle. And as soon as the Sergeant Major walked out, I remembered him from the Liverpool Scottish. He was an old friend of, came here eventually for my wedding. He was my best man eventually. But I saw him walk out with his clipboard, and he didn't look at us. We were common soldiers, weren't we? And he was the Sergeant Major. And he started to read out all these names, and then he came to my name. Now, we in the Liverpool Scottish were very proud of our numbers, which all started 2932. If you had 2932, it meant that you were a volunteer. We weren't an intake, we weren't conscripts, you see. 2932, you were a volunteer. So he's reading down, and then he came to my 2932, and he looked across, he didn't go any further, he looked across, oh, go and stand over there. So I went and stood over there, and the other panel of people were dispersed to various places, and I, of course, went to live in the Schloss. Had a wonderful time with him. He said, we'll say that you're my orderly, but we'll be demobbed in no time. So I spent the next 6 or 7 weeks living it up with him. Oh, God, it was wonderful. We had a wonderful time. The other side of the river, there was a little, what's it called? A ferry across. But this ferry was most unusual, across the bays to the other side. It was a punt on a long wire and a hoop, and this hoop went over a wire which was stretched tight across the river. So to get to the other side, you simply pushed out, put the rudder hard against the current, which was flowing, you know, from right to left, shall we say, and the current wanted to send you down, the rudder wanted to send you up, and this wire and the hoop on the wire made you go straight across, you landed at the other side, and you gave the ferryman a cigarette or whatever, you see, and you got to the other side, and the little beer house on the other side, which was much better than the one by the castle, wasn't it? It had to be much better. So every night, of course, I was at the beer house on the other side, local girls, etc. They were very friendly, the local girls, and when it came to getting back to the Schloss, the ferryman lived on the Schloss side, didn't he? So I had to go upstream, get undressed, go upstream, swim across, the current was quite fast, of course, swim across to the other side, to the Schloss side, then walk back to the where the punt was, punt across, pick up my clothes,